For breakfast, I squeeze half a lemon.
Okay.
Add a teaspoon of bee pollen and 4 drops of propolis, which is a bee product, and honey, and a hot drink.
So it's all about the bees in your house in the morning?
Yes.
Tell me more about that. Is there a method to it?
No, I was advised by one of my sons to start the bee pollen,
uh-huh.
and by a granddaughter to take the propolis. So I just followed.
You just throw it all in the water and see what happens. You haven't sprouted wings or anything yet, have you?
It makes a lovely hot drink in the morning.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
You know. And then I usually follow that up with a banana,
uh-huh.
and a cup of tea. And that's it. That's my breakfast.
Happy days.
Mm-hmm.
And has your breakfast changed much over the course of your life, other than the bee pollen?
No, not really. Well, I only started when my daughter was getting married down in Skibbereen. I was breakfasting with a friend of hers the next morning,
yeah.
and she sang the praises of lemons.
Okay.
She said she starts the day with a lemon, she finishes the day with a lemon. And whenever you Google lemon, it's amazing. It is actually an antibiotic.
Yes.
And so... that's 10 years ago, so I've been doing that. I've been making that drink for 10
Amazing. Amazing. So, just as a way of introduction, could you tell us your name and your age?
My name is Isabel Woods, and I'll be 94 in a couple of months' time.
Incredible.
But I was wanting to make a wee excuse before I start.
Yes, please.
I would like to be excused if... from time to time, I might hesitate a little
uh-huh.
to find the right word that I'm looking for to explain something. Now, this is something that really comes with age.
Okay.
And and also, there's times when I don't recognize my own voice because it can change with the years too.
Oh yes.
So so at any rate. And you know, one of the perks of getting to 80 is that you get 25p added onto your pension. Unbelievable.
How have you spent that? It must be hard to spend that kind of money.
Oh, but it is unbelievable. It cost him more to do that. But that's a fact, and it's not many people know that.
Wow.
And you don't get the same perk for 90.
That's true. You should get 50 for turning 90, shouldn't you? Well, your excuses are warranted because I often will pause for 30 seconds at a time myself. I look for the right words, so
yes.
We'll be in good company if there's, you know, a couple of minutes of silence thrown in there.
Oh, good, good.
There's a wee question I always love to start off with, Isabel, and I usually am asking this to all sorts of people, okay? And the question is, what is the first thing that you can remember?
It's whenever I have memories of sitting in a high chair. I can't go much further back.
Wow,
it's
impressive.
And I remember having mashed potato, which I used to use a teaspoon and make little sandcastles. And you know, I have been a potato person ever since.
I bet, yeah. I mean, it is. It's a fun food. You can do a lot with it, can't you?
You
besides
can.
From making sandcastles, you can eat it in about 20 different ways, which I've always loved. Always handy.
So that as early as I can go back anyway.
Wow. And where was home for you?
Larne. Mm-hmm.
Very nice. And tell me about the house that you grew up in and, you know, your garden and the surrounding area.
Well, actually, I would need to go back a wee bit further to explain that.
Okay.
My father had a dairy farm 3 miles north of Larne on the Corncastle Road. And he used to bring milk in to the three main hotels in Larne by pony and milk cart. And my brother and sister were both born out at Ballytober. But by the time I came along... my father had sold his farm to his father-in-law, who owned the neighbouring farm.
Okay.
And we had moved into Larne and in the Victoria Terrace. And he opened a butcher's shop. And in fact, I think he ended up with two.
Oh, wow.
But I was born in 1928. It was just a year before the slump or the depression.
Yes.
And so as that went on, my father's customers had got to the stage where they couldn't pay their bills.
Yeah.
And as is a custom in a small town, they were all his friends. Mm. So he kept on supplying them, and they said when it blew over that they would honour the dead. So he kept supplying them. But unfortunately, that depression lasted till 10 years.
Wow.
They thought it would blow over, you know.
Yeah.
So it put him out of business.
I bet, yeah.
And then my parents separated.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't know why.
And if you don't mind me saying, separation would have been far less common in those days than it would be now, wasn't
it? Yes, it would have been.
It's interesting, yeah.
Yes. And so, at any rate, one of my father's sisters got us taken to Victoria Girls' Home in Ballysillan in Belfast.
Okay.
Nan and I. But Andy stayed with friends in Lorne because he was attending the Lorne Grammar School.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, we were 6 years in the Victoria Homes.
Wow.
But I've no bad memories of it. It was a very well-run establishment. I was only 4 and a half.
Wow.
And Nan was 7 and a half
When you moved?
Whenever.
You spent 4 years kind of in the country, probably surrounded by animals, doing wee bits around the farm, and then you became a city girl very quickly?
Well, yes. Well, at 6 years' time,
I did.
And, my father and mother had separated for those 6 years. And during those years, he was land steward up at Garntor Hotel near Glenarm.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother ended up doing housekeeper at Mourne Grange Boys' School in Kilkeel. So they were quite a... but fate brought them both back into Belfast.
Oh.
My father's had a nephew who wanted his assistants to open up a butcher's shop in Upper North Street.
Yeah.
And it was very successful. It was called Andrew Crow and Son. It was just in the corner of Wine Tavern Street and on Upper North Street.
Yeah.
And my mother had answered an advert for a baker. Major McGowan was looking for a baker, for he was owning the first milk bar in Belfast. I forget the street now. But at any rate, my mother got the job.
Wow.
So that's what brought her back. And in fact, it was so successful that he opened a second one opposite Anders McCauley's.
Did you say a milk bar?
A milk bar, yes.
Wow.
And he opened the second one at Castle Junction opposite Anders McCauley's.
Uh-huh.
And they were both very, very successful. He would go, in fact, my mother had to train other ones.
Oh, wow.
And Major McGowan used to go on his travels. And if he came across something that he really liked, he would bring a wee sample back to my mother and say, Mrs. Clements, could you make that? And I remember we found a notebook when we were looking through her papers eventually, and it was full of all her recipes.
Mm,
and,
amazing. But
the one I can remember best was lovely little wheaten rolls, really.
Oh.
So I don't know how they got together again. I sort of feel it might have been my brother because he kept in touch with both of them.
Nice.
But at any rate, they got together, and that's why we got out of Victoria Homes, and it was a great homecoming. My father, because he was working, he was short-sighted, and Andy and I both inherited his short sight. So whenever he was helping the cousin in the butcher shop in North Street, it was convenient for him because of his sight to get a house up the Shankill Road because the trams passed that way. And so we came home to 53 Dundee Street, and the streets in that area of Belfast were all they were given all Scottish names, like Aberdeen and Argyle.
Yeah.
And so we came home in the spring of 1939, just before the war.
Wow.
It was a wonderful place to grow up, because we had great street games.
Mm.
We were never bored.
Tell me about some of the games you would play.
Well, we had a great a program of ball games.
Mm-hmm.
And also we'd played hopscotch, and we'd certain a routine for skipping, and we all joined in. The whole street children all joined into all of these, and really, and we had other ring games, and Purion Whip. And I can remember the old man living opposite us was called Hutchison, and he was affectionately known as Old Hutch. And so some of these peeries were jumping.
Yeah.
So we had to make window breakers, we called them. So we had to make sure that we didn't go near his windows, because he kept a close eye on us.
I bet he
and
did.
And then another one was swinging on the lamps.
Oh.
And the higher you got your rope up the lamp, the bigger the swing.
Yeah.
So if anybody tall passed, we would ask them to do the needful. So, and you know, there was never a bicycle, because people couldn't. It was real poverty. That during those depression years, there was no handouts, social handouts.
Mm.
It really was poverty.
Yeah.
Real poverty. And so people really didn't have the money for such luxuries as buying their children bicycles, you know.
Yeah.
Our streets were back to back with the falls, streets in the falls. And, you know, there was a great camaraderie between the two lots. You know, the falls people, the Shankill was known as a great shopping place.
Okay.
And the falls people came round to shop in the Shankill. And if there was bands parading, they came to watch the bands. And we did the same to the, if there was bands going down the falls road.
Yeah.
They came on 11th night to join our small wee bonfire and partake of our lemonade and buns.
Sure.
And, you know, the word, we never knew of the word bigotry.
Mm.
And, you know, it really saddens me today to see the state that we're in here in this wee country, you know.
Absolutely.
But it was a wonderful place to grow up in those days, you know. The people in those streets, they hadn't much money, like ourselves at that time. But that hearts are gold, because if anybody's trouble was everybody's trouble, it really was a wonderful place to grow up.
It's beautiful. You
know? Wonderful.
What do you remember of the war then?
Well, we were evacuated to my uncle's farm, very near Ballytober. It was my mother's home farm, and we attended a one classroom school.
Okay.
And I don't know how that teacher, she was called Miss Shanks, and we all were in awe of her. But I mean, she had all the different grades in that one classroom.
My goodness.
So we stayed there till we outgrew it, and then we had to go to Newry to meet my father's brother outside Derrybeg, outside Newry, and I attended the model school then. In Newry, and then we came back to Belfast in 1942, and my mother got me to the Belfast Royal Academy.
Nice.
But she, just before I was about to sit my junior, she took me to have my eyes tested in a hospital, and I remember the name. It was Dr. Daniels, the woman.
You have some memory on you. That's amazing.
But she really scared my mother. She said, if she was my daughter, I would take her from school immediately and put her in the Land Army. The Land Army was, we were digging for victory at that time. The girls all had to help to grow vegetables.
Yeah.
But at any rate, my mother took her advice. She said if I kept on studying, that my sight would deteriorate far more quickly. So my mother and I was heartbroken, because I enjoyed all the lovely subjects. I was very fond of astronomy, musical appreciation, the games and the PE. I really loved the school.
Mm.
And so at any rate, I was at home for housekeeping for a couple of months. And then some friend said, she knew that my favourite subject was arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, why don't you go to the Contometer School down in Hard Street in Belfast? It was the forerunner of the computer, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what I did. And they were supposed to get you a job once you finished the course. But, you know, there really weren't many jobs at that time either, you know.
Yeah.
And so at any rate, eventually they got me a job in J.P. Corey's, the timber.
Oh, yes.
Merchants in Corporation Street. And I was shown up to the bookkeeper's office, and it was a gloomy wee small windows and big sloping desks to hold large ledgers.
Yeah.
And the boss was like, Mr. Burns, he was like a character out of Dickens. and his assistant was a girl called Molly. And she had the most minute writing and figures. But I had to, all day long, in these great big ledgers in this gloomy room, and the wee tiny writing, I'd had to just keep these great big tots. And I felt cheated because when I'd been at the computer school, we learned compound interest in foreign currency.
Sure,
and all the other, and I felt sort of wasted.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I really loved me. I was very fond of Molly, and that's what kept me there. So I was there for a couple of years, and then, of course, I had to get the eyes tested again. And they deteriorated quite a bit, so I had no option but to leave.
Mm.
And so I left there and, again, was home housekeeping. When my best friend, who lived about four doors down, asked me would I go for an interview to New Forge with her. New Forge was a canning factory at the up New Forge Lane, up in Upper Malone.
Yep.
And so I went with her anyway, and we got accepted. But when it came to the day to go, Peggy reneged. But I went on anyway. And I spent 10 great years up there in New Forge. But
what did you do with them?
Didn't want any office work.
Yeah.
It was, you were learning how to prepare vegetables for canning.
Yeah.
And Then I was promoted to the canning line,
ooh,
which was great
nice.
Fun. But you had to do shift 6 to 2 and 2 to 10.
Wow.
But I agreed to do that, and it became a way of life.
Yeah.
And then one day I was summoned to the personnel manager's office, and he asked me would I take the job on of being factory clerk. So I explained to him why I had come to New Forge. It was to get away from paperwork. He says, well, you won't be tied to a desk. He says, you'll have to go around the different departments in the factory, get their production figures and set their code numbers, etc. So when my father heard it was going to be office hours, he insisted on me taking it.
Yeah.
And I must say, I had 10 great years there.
Wow. So when you work these 2 to 10 shifts, how would you get home again at 10 o'clock at night?
Well, the thing was, while I was working in J.P. Corey's, I walked to work because I handed in, in those days you handed your pay packet into your mother, unopened, and I was earning £1.02.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days now, the professionals, the top rate for a professional was 1,000 then.
Yeah.
And when you think of what it is today,
I know.
You'd really made it if you were earning 1,000. At any rate, I spent my pocket money on riding lessons because before I was school age, I used to spend a lot of the summer on an uncle's farm, and I used to follow the ploughman up and down the rigs, followed the plough, and my reward was to get a ride home on the big Clydesdale. And I had a great love of horses.
Mm.
And then he used to go straight into the stable, and I was there with him and among the legs of the horse. And he would have lit the tilly lamp and started currying the horse before he did anything else, because they were important for his farm. And if any of his friends called, they had to just join him in the stable. So I had developed a great love of horses. So when I had my pocket money, I spent it up in Craigie Riding School. There's a riding school. And it was partly because of the horses, but also because I loved the open countryside.
Mm.
And it was a means of getting out into the countryside.
Absolutely.
So when I was going, I walked to work to save money. And I had to walk down the Shankill and up York Street to get to Corporation Street. So I was passing the Piddington's bicycle shop this day, and there was a lovely wee Raleigh Linton sport in the window.
Mm.
And I looked at it and I thought, oh dear, I would love that. But my father, my parents would never have, if they could have afforded it, they wouldn't buy me a bicycle because of my short sight. They were scared of my safety.
Yeah.
So at any rate, I looked at that and I thought, now, if I could exchange the flesh and blood steed for this wee steel one, I could escape from the city more often. So it took me, I started saving up, and it took me 2 years.
Wow.
I'd started work at 16. At the age of 18, I was able to purchase a wee rally Linton with a three-speed gear.
Wow.
And I was in trepidation when I brought it home, because there were kitchen houses in Dundee Street, so you had to walk through the kitchen to get to the covered yard at the back. And, of course, I just had to wheel my bicycle in past them. It was a kitchen living room, actually. It was actually like a living room, but we called them the kitchens because there was a wee scullery at the back. But so I had to walk the bicycle past them. And there was a great stony silence. and not a word was spoken. But eventually, when they saw that I was coming home safe, they relaxed a bit.
Cool.
You know, but they never would have provided. So I didn't have a bicycle as a child at all. I had to wait till 18.
Well, this is maybe a silly question, but how did you learn?
Well, they used to go out to visit my father's farm, my father's home farm at outside Ballynure, a place called Headwood. And the family all gathered there at weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And the treat for me was that I was allowed to ride this great big sit-up-and-beg bicycle with a back-pedaled brake to go to the neighbouring farm to get tomatoes for the tea.
Wow.
And that, I could hardly stretch it, actually. But, you know, that was wonderful.
Mm.
Just going along at that height and the exhilaration of the wind in your hair. I was 14 at the time.
Yeah.
So that's how I learned to ride a bicycle.
Fantastic.
But I had to be at 18 before.
So when you were working in the Cannon factory then, you would cycle home at 10 o'clock
at
night?
Yes, yes.
That's incredible. Uh-huh. What would you do for lighting?
Well, you had your lamp.
Yeah. How was your lamp powered?
There were carbon lamps at that time, but there was ordinary battery lamps at that time, because that would have been, what would that have been, the early 50s,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yes, there were battery lamps, but quite often the carbide was used for them, you know.
Very good.
But in the really bad winter days now, I would have taken a tram down the Shankill and got a bus up the Malone Road to get to it, you know. But when I could, when the weather permitted, I always rode the bicycle.
So you bought this wee rally then?
Yes.
You loved it?
And then...
you seemed to do a bit more cycling then after that?
Well, after I purchased that bike, my sister plucked up the courage and she bought one. So we had three wonderful years hostling. We joined the Youth Hostel Association, which was a wonderful association because it let you venture further away, stay overnight, and then come back. So it opened up. You could go much further. So we had wonderful years, and then during the winter to keep fit, we joined the Trinity Harriers in Belfast to do a bit of cross country just to keep ourselves fit.
Oh yeah,
and we went there on our bicycles, and we met a lovely like-minded lady called Ina McCune, and Ina was a racing cyclist. And when she saw that we came on bicycles, she asked us if, this was 1948, she asked would we enter for a 5-mile novice race the following spring, 49. She was hard to refuse, so we said we would, because we thought, well, 2.5 miles out and 2.5, not too bad. So, so the following spring anyway, we turned up as promised to the 6th milestone at Glengormley, because that's where all the time trials were run from. And I got a second in it.
Wow.
And then they encouraged me to try again. So I did. I rode all the races that year. Ina won them all, of course. I think I beat her by about 2 seconds on a 12-mile, which was a very unusual.
Wow, yeah.
Because we never really did 12 miles. It was always 10, 20, 25, you know. But at any rate, she got the BAR Cup, which is the best all-rounder cup at the end of the season. So the next season was 1950, and I had better luck then, because I'd changed. Unfortunately, I had to change my wee bike because I noticed that the racing girls all had lightweight bikes, and they were all gents' bikes for extra strength.
Yeah.
So I changed to a Claude Butler, with which hindsight was really too big for me.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, in that particular season, I broke the 20 and 25 mile records.
Wow.
And I beat Enel, got the BAR.
Ah, class.
But the next 2 years, I never competed, because in 1951, my father had taken ill.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, he had had double pneumonia as a young man, because he rode a motorbike and he was in a rowing club, so there was no wet gear then.
Yeah.
He took double pneumonia, and in those days, if you had double pneumonia, you had no chance. The doctor had told his parents, he didn't know about it, but he said, if he pulls through, it'll be a miracle, and if he does, he'll never live to scratch a grey head. That's the way he put it.
Interesting.
So at any rate, he had free health right up to the last year, 51, and he was 60 that year, actually. So when he went to get diagnosed, they said, look, it's to do with the muscles of the heart. We can't give you new muscles. The strain of the recovering from the double pneumonia had weakened the muscles of the heart.
Mm.
And the only way he was pulled through was by the skilled nursing of an old nurse. She never left his bedside. You know, and she kept changing. Was he sweated? She kept changing the clothes. And she, you know, it was her skill that saved him, really.
Yeah.
So because they could do nothing for him in hospital, he had to stay at home. So I helped to nurse him in that year, and unfortunately, he died on the 3rd of December that year.
Mm-hmm.
In 1952, my sister had organised her wedding for August, and so in a way that helped us in our grieving.
Yeah.
Because preparations had been made and all the decorating had to be done, and in those days when we painted the wall, we dipped a wee rag into a different coloured paint and run it down and it to form patterns like a wallpaper. and we used butter boxes for parts of the furniture. So I started graining those.
Yeah.
And doors, I was graining doors. And of course, it got to be that I had to work my way down the street graining for the neighbours.
So you had a wee graining business.
So at any rate, that's why I didn't compete that second year. And in 1953... Ina, who had kept was a great friend, she asked me to join her husband and her for a tour down to the south of France.
Oh, wow.
So it was a wonderful opportunity.
That's amazing, yeah.
So after we did that anyway, she had coached me to join the Belfast Cycling Club. So I was a member of it. And we, in fact, I would like to tell you a wee bit about it.
Yes, please do.
It was formed in 1892, and only the elite could afford bicycles in those days.
Sure.
And the man who started the first club was the Reverend George Gore Mervyn from St. Patrick's Church in Ballymacarrett, East Belfast. And it started originally just as a... only the parishioners could join it, but very shortly it had to be open to everybody. So the uniform for this club, you had to have a uniform. It was a navy jacket, navy trousers with red piping, a peaked cap with a silver badge, and that had to be worn in every club run.
Wow!
And there was a club bugler. He was elected every year because he set the pace of the club, the pace of the club, and also, as he was approaching a village or town, he went ahead and warned them that there was a run coming, traffic.
And how many people would have been in the run?
In those days, as I say, it was only the elite that mm-hmm. could have afforded it. And the presidents of the club at that time were very well known people. And in 1906, Captain James Craig.
Oh, yes.
He left after 6 years to join politics with Sir Edward Carson.
Mm-hmm.
But he stayed as a vice president for 23 years. He kept in touch with the club. And then the man who followed him was Sir Robert Kennedy, whose home was at Cultural Manor.
Very nice.
Where the folk museum is now. And he served for 24 years as president, and the highlight of the calendar year was his invitation to Cultural to have cake and tea on the lawn with his family.
Wow.
That was a wonderful, and there's photographs of it in the Cultural, that was in the house at Cultural. So he kept going till he died, actually, in 36, and then Mr. W.S. Cackey took over then. Now, he had been treasurer of the club for 22 years, and he served for 33 as a president, and the total of his years in the Belfast was 74 years.
Wow.
And when he died, I was honoured to be given his club badge.
Very good. This
club badge, we had to get permission from the Belfast Corporation to use the Belfast coat of arms.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very prestigious badge. It was made of silver and enamel. So I was really greatly honoured. Some of the vice presidents that come to mind was Mr. G.W. Wolfe of Harland Wolfe.
Yes.
W.J. Chambers, who built the racing cars. And there's one of those cars in the Transport Museum.
Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm. And there were some wonderful, I mean, the vice presidents were all the right honourables and MPs and anybody of note about the city. But they had, there was over about 120 in the clubs, you know.
Yeah.
Because they were very social. They had a great calendar of club runs and socials, you know. So it was very, very, very popular in those days. And it's back to that now with some of the clubs that have grown to that size.
That's,
you know?
Right, yeah.
But it was a wonderful club. And they had very, very well-known long-distance riders. In fact, one of them was picked for the 1912 Olympics. And he was taking part in a time trial, 196-mile time trial.
My goodness.
So we were renowned, really, for our distance riders. And
yeah.
Also, we had wonderful track riders and time trial people. So after we came back from France, we at the club meeting, it was suggested by someone, they saw that we were back tanned and fit. and they said, why don't you girls try a distance record, a place-to-place distance record, to carry on the tradition of the club.
Yes.
And so Ina picked Derry to Belfast, and I picked Enniskillen to Belfast.
Nice.
And so that's how, really, I got interested or carried on with other distance rides, you know. But it was through their suggestion, really.
Yeah, carrying really, that legacy on, as you said.
It was really, the motivation behind it for me was to bring a claim to the club.
Yeah.
Because you were always wanting to keep the club name on the map, you know.
So what distance or what race or what record or achievement are you most proudest of hitting for the club?
Well, I suppose the one that comes to mind is the end-to-end. From Mizzenhead to Fairhead, it was 386 miles.
Oh my goodness!
And I did it in 23 hours and 2 minutes.
23 hours.
23 hours and 2 minutes. And the timekeeper started his watch when you left Mizzen,
yeah,
and stopped it when you got to Fairhead. So if you took time for a three-course meal or anything, it would add on to your time, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just going to ask you maybe some silly questions. Did you sleep?
No.
The whole way through, 23 hours?
Oh, yes. I started at 6 o'clock at Mizzenhead. 6 o'clock at Mizzenhead. and rode through the night, first of all. That would take me through the night. And when I got to the Cork, when I got the length of Cork, it was getting dusk. And I stopped to, I think I had to change my a spur bike with me because some of the roads were very rough.
Yeah.
And I had to change over to the heavy tired bike on the rough sections. So when I got to Cork, I pulled on a pair of tights for the night riding and a big white sweater because the van had to keep me in view.
Yes.
During the night. And one of my most precious memories is that there's quite a climb up out of Cork called Waterglass Hill. And I was going up, I was heading up, I got a lamp on the bike at that time too. I was heading up the Waterglass Hill and I began to think, oh, I've quite a journey. I've quite a journey ahead of me here. And all of a sudden, out of the gloom, petals were strewn on my path.
Really?
Wonderful. It was the McCarthy family.
Wow.
Who had helped us. He was a wonderful international rider, a wonderful cyclist, the son of the family. Well, you know, when they did that, it gave me a great boost. Mm. And I never thought of distance after that.
Incredible.
It was wonderful. Lovely memory to have, really.
That is lovely. What year was that, Isabel?
1955.
55, wow.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Peters, in her Passing the Torch book, they had a photograph of me at the back of it. It's always alphabetical. I'm always at the back of these books.
Are you in that book, are you? Here, I've got the book here. 1 second, let me have a look. Mm-hmm.
What was that?
Let's see.
It's at the very back.
There you are. That's you there.
And when I was getting her to sign the book at one of her lunches,
yes,
she said, we put the petals in. You see the two or three red petals there?
Oh, yes, there they are.
Mary got those put in.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
It was a lovely thing.
There
to
you
do.
Are. Is that the... That's the men's bike you were talking about there?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Well, I had to change that Cobb Butler for far too big. So I ordered, it was a 21 inch, and I really should have had a 20 and a half. So I ordered that from Mercian, and they got me one. They made me a frame, 21 and a half, and it cost me £15.
Oh, my goodness.
And it took £15 to build it up. So 30 pounds,
that's a,
really.
That's a big bike, yeah. Amazing.
So that was the Mercian.
There you are, Isabel. You've been sitting on my shelf this whole time. That's amazing.
But it was lovely of Mary to put. She's a lovely person. Really.
Oh, yes. No, we love Mary. Mary's really great. Really great. So what did you do in the 60s?
Well, you see, there were four... All Ireland record. If it crossed the border, it was an Irish record.
Okay.
If it was above the border, it was a Northern Ireland record.
Okay.
So after I did the NTA and I got married that year, and I wrote an article about honeymoon a wheel. We went off to a tour in France, and
did the cycle as well.
Why, that was it.
Yeah.
On our bikes, yes, and. At any rate, the next race that I thought I would do was a 24-hour attempt.
Mm-hmm.
That was all done in Northern Ireland.
So your 23-hour wasn't enough. You needed a wee bit more.
And really, if you were to ask me what the biggest challenge was, that's the one I would say. Because
the 24, yeah.
Because I had planned it for the same end of June, which is to give me the most daylight.
Yeah.
And we met up at the 6 milestone again, 6 o'clock in the evening, and it was very foreboding looking the weather. And really, what a night it turned out to be. It was solid rain, consistent sun. It was really, it was something to believe. But at any rate, my timekeeper, when we did the 12 hours, he stopped me he said, no, enough's enough, because it really was terrific.
Yeah.
And I did 200 miles in that time, but I couldn't claim the 12-hour record because the schedule had been made out for a 24-hour.
Yes, of course.
And on a 24-hour record, you're allowed to cover a road four times.
Okay.
But for a 12-hour, only twice.
So
because this was for the... And you know that we'd stopped them, I was determined to have another go.
Mm-hmm.
So I planned for in a month's time because... I gave myself a month because I wanted to ride in the Navan Irish 25-mile time trial and the Wirral Cup 25-mile for the Dunleary Cycling Week. It was held every year in Dunleary. And I won both, but in my last sprint in the Wirral Cup, I pulled a muscle in the calf.
No.
So a good friend, Bobby McGregor, who was the trainer of Glentoran at that time, a very respected sports injury person. And Bobby said, there's three pulls in that muscle. He says, I was supposed to start the next week. He says, no way. So at any rate, when that got right, then I took another complaint. That was stomach cramps. And I noticed that it happened after I had eaten food,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes could last for 3 hours. So I went back to Bobby anyway, and he said, it's stillness. Now, stillness, I'd often heard of stillness, but never had experienced it. And he said, it's the strain of trying to keep at top fitness for over a length of time.
Okay.
So he says, there's no way you're going to have to stop cycling for 3 weeks. So again, I had to go back, and the 1st of September then became the date of the 24-hour.
Wow, wow, wow.
Well, by that time, the day that it arrived, it was a strong northeasterly wind.
Oof.
And I was going up from Whitehead to Cushendall twice.
Yeah.
And you were facing the wind. But at any rate, it was so cold that I had to rub imbrication on the legs to try and keep them. I was using such a lot of energy to keep warm.
Yes.
And I'd just be shouting for cups of hot tea all the
time. Yeah.
Normally they couldn't get me to drink tea, take much tea.
Yeah.
But I just needed it kept warm.
Yeah.
And I had to change my outfit four times with the rain. I got heavy rain there too.
Yeah.
And I had to change four times. And at any rate, the tights that I'd pulled on for the night riding had to stay on over the shorts, and that caused a bit of saddle soreness for the last 50
minutes. Sure, yeah.
and the thing was, I'd covered 378 in 24 hours, and yet in the 23 hours, I'd done 386. so people ask me, it was only eight miles between the two.
Yeah.
And they ask me, how did that happen? How would that happen that you've done less than a 24?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, it was the weather.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
But so that would have been my biggest challenge.
Wow. Well, I'm sure people have asked you this quite a lot. Why did you do it?
It was to bring a claim to the club, really.
That was why.
That really...
While everyone else was in their beds, drinking their cup of tea and listening to their radio, you were out there getting rained on, and that's why.
And you know, I could have paddled quicker going through Larne because the streets were swimming with water. I could have faster paddling than pedaling, really.
Sure.
But really, it was all the motivation. The motivation was to keep the club's name forward, you know. That's really what it was about. It was such a wonderful club. And you know, it's not the racing men that keep a club together for 100 years, because it kept going for 100 years. And it went through two world wars.
Yeah.
And it's not the racing men alone that can keep the name to the fore. It's the ordinary club cyclist that loves the club runs and the club room chat and all the social events. That's the backbone of the club.
Yeah.
But I suppose the ideal thing would be the racing man who had a love of the simple club life too, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, it's a club, very, very proud of that club. But it started in 1892, so we finished. We closed it in 1992.
Yeah. And like, why do you think it's so important that clubs like this exist today? You know, these social places.
Well, I think it's a wonderful pastime. Yeah. There's nothing can beat cycling for a pastime. You know, it is really it keeps people together for years. And I mean, we had a Billy Kirk. He was a cyclist out of Nard Cycling Club. He used to run reunions of old cyclists, and in 1909, he circulated around all the clubs and invited all the old cyclists to attend a reunion in the Marine Hotel in Bangor. And at any rate, he got such a response that he had to upsize his room three times till we ended up with the main room.
Wow.
And there was over 150, and there's not many sports at that time. I mean, they were all grey hairs, grey heads, and some with no hair. and when it had been 10 years since the previous reunion, and at that time of life, your appearance can change greatly.
Absolutely.
And so they were all trying to recognise each other from the racing days, and the room was full of big round tables. And by the time they'd all settled into their places, there was 11 names scrolled down a big screen. And Billy did them. He was doing MC. And he called out each of those names. And then he said, sadly, he said, they're not with us anymore. Well, there was a deadly hush filled that room, because everyone was in a shock of sadness, because every one of those names were known to everybody in that room.
Yeah.
And they had done a lot to keep cycling going, the sport of cycling. There were some wonderful champions, some great timekeepers, some great legislators. They were a wonderful crowd. That was the only ones that Billy had known. There was other ones, I'm sure, but weren't listed. And I was sitting beside my friend May, and I said, when I recovered enough myself, for I was greatly saddened, I said, May, you know, the one thing all those men had in common was they were great storytellers.
Mm.
I said, because I got amused with many of them. And I said, they've all died with them. And I said, the stories that are circulating around this room tonight, because it was a night of nostalgia, really.
Yeah.
I said, they'll all go the same way if we don't do something about it. So at the end of the evening, we approached the MC, Billy, and said to Billy, because as everyone had arrived, they had to write their name and address, you know, when they were coming in. And we said, would you write to all those cyclists and ask them to send in their favourite story, their favourite, accompanied by a photograph if they have it. Oh, Billy said, I would have no time to do that. He said, he was 72, actually. He says, I'm still training and racing. And he was 72.
Go ahead, Billy.
He was the first cyclist at the age of 18. He had broken the hour for a 25 mile.
Mm.
He did 58, 28. And at the age of 72, he was bettering that time.
No way.
50 years later.
That's mad.
And I said to him, what do you account for that, Billy? He said, it's the difference in the bicycles, he said, and the multi-gears.
Interesting.
The multi-gears and the scientific training.
Yes.
He says, it all adds up. So at any rate, May had been the secretary of the Landscape Association of Ireland for 28 years, and she was retired. So May volunteered to do all this secretarial work, and she did a wonderful job. Well, the stories came in thick and fast, and in 2010, just a year later, we produced a book called Recycled Memories.
Lovely.
And it did what we wanted it to do. It captured the spirit of cycling during the 50s, late 40s, 50s and 60s. A wonderful, I feel very proud of that. I was only one of four compilers. because May was the second one.
Yeah.
Billy Kirk, the MC, was the other, and Lab Collins, who had been the secretary of the Belfast Cycling Club for 50 years.
Wow.
He was the fourth. And but really, I think that was a worthwhile. It gave everybody a chance to make their mark in that book.
Mm.
But, you know, there's not many other sports that you could think of that could... There would be as many old cycles keeping together like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a rare thing, really.
It is. It's a beautiful thing as well. You know, it's really special.
So I took longer for that than what you thought.
Oh, no, it's perfect. I mean, we're here to talk, so it's all good. There is one thing we didn't cover because I didn't know where to ask. I'd love to know, and it's just all I have in my head is a couple of words, so maybe it's a story, maybe it's not. Something about a donkey in the bath. Does that mean something to you?
Well, whenever you asked about what you would relate to a story in a pub, I thought, well, no, that's the first one I thought of. It would be a bit humorous. Well, we were keeping goats at that time, and there were two genteel ladies that lived near Drumara who had really done a lot to improve the breed of goats in Northern Ireland.
Okay.
One of them had had this donkey, and it was getting quite old, and it was beginning to nip the goats. And the other lady was getting, there was fights between the two, arguments because of this donkey annoying her, the goats. So they asked us, would we give it a home? So Rosie came to us anyway, and she got the run of the place, really. But there was one winter's day we couldn't find her, and our wee bit of land is skirted on two sides by the Rivarnet River. And there was that corner could be very swampy. And there's where we found her. She was stuck on that. So we got a friend of ours had been converting an ambulance into a camper van.
Okay.
And he brought us out the stretcher. So the stretcher was got and taken down, and the tractor and link box went down. They got Rosie onto the stretcher and onto the link box, brought her up, and of course we sent for the vet.
Yeah.
And the vet came. Oh, he says, it's hypothermia. He says, have you any port whiskey in the house? No. Any port? No. Have you any methylated spirits? Yes, we have methylated spirits. So he put a whole bottle of methylated spirits down Rosie's throat.
Oh, my goodness.
And he says, what she needs now is a hot bath. Well, and away he went. and we sort of looked at each other and thought, he didn't tell us how to do that. But at that time, we were living in a stone built cottage.
Yeah.
And you went through this lean-to kitchen, and in the corner of it was a bathroom. So Rosie was carried in through the kitchen into the bath. And by that time, a hot bath was getting run.
Uh-huh.
And with difficulty, Rosie was lifted into the bath. And the children just kept pouring the water over the bits that maybe weren't covered to keep her, to heat her up.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, while this was going on, the furniture was getting taken out of our living room, all but a sofa. And bales of straw were getting brought up. And a great roaring fire was put on. Now, lucky enough, the floor of this living room was the wee old-fashioned red tiles.
Oh, yes.
So eventually, anyway, Rosie was lifted out again with difficulty and taken into the living room. And, of course, the towels she was getting rubbed with, children all took. They were all gathered around, and they were rubbing with and her dressers, her dryers were brought. And we propped her up against these hay, straw bales, and so Peter, he volunteered to spend the night on the sofa, and so after the third night on the sofa, he was wakened by the smell of methylated spirits. For Rosie had turned the corner and had gone over to see who her roommate was. So at any rate, when she was fit to go out, we opened the front door to get her out. She wouldn't go. She wouldn't go over the doorstep.
I love that.
So we had to actually, three of us had to push her out. But we kept a close eye on her after that. But you know, it was, and we were so concerned about it. It was never a photograph taken of it.
Sure, yeah.
You know, we were all so concerned about her.
Yeah.
So she lived for a lot of years.
I bet. I mean, I think you probably broke another world record there for most pampered donkey. That's incredible.
Well, I must say, I took that bath to save her life, I think.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad I asked. That was very, very funny. What? These are a couple of questions I ask everybody now, just as we kind of wrap up. I always ask people, and you can take this whatever way you want. You've already shared a cycling one. But Isabel, what has been the most challenging moment of your life so far?
Well, I've more or less told you that.
Is that the cycling one, yeah?
That would be that cycling one.
Anything else other than
the
bike?
There was other ones, but more personal, really.
That's fine, yep.
I mean, I lost my first son in 1981. A cave diving exercise, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a challenging time.
I bet. How do you go through that?
Well,
suppose there's nothing else you can do, is there?
No, but at that time, I was an obsessive. I loved dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a when we came out of the Victoria Homes, I was 10 and a half. And so the early teenage years, Nan and I did tap dancing. And then as we got further into the teens, ballroom dancing became our obsession. And my best friend lived four doors down, and her sister was my sister's best friend, so the four of us had great foursomes dancing. And we were at a dinner dance when we got the news about the accident. And although dancing was really one of my best pastimes, I hadn't the heart to dance for 14 years.
Mm.
I just, for a feel to dance, you've got to have a bit of joy in your soul,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that was another challenge, a different sort of a challenge,
Absolutely.
Really, but it was a challenge.
Yeah. Mm. Talk to me about set dancing.
Mm-hmm.
You're a fan?
Well, as I say, I didn't dance for 14 years. And we were at Peter's brother Brian's 60th party, birthday party, and we met a couple. We were having tea with them, actually, at the wee table we were sitting at. One was an Italian lady called Fernanda, and her husband, Don, was a colleague of Brian's through work. And they were asking Peter what sort of music he liked. Well, he was very fond of classical, and he was fond of jazz, and he was fond of Irish music, any sort. But at any rate, I was the only one, he wasn't too keen on country, actually. But at any rate, Fernanda said, "Why don't you come down to the Ashley Hall some night?" She said, "There's live music there." So we sort of promised we would, but a year passed because Peter owned his own business and I had to help in the office in the evenings. So that really, we hadn't time for socialising.
Yeah.
But after a year, after a year had passed, Peter just said one night, "I think we'll go down to Ashley Hall."
Mm.
So we went down, and when we thought we'll just go in and sit near the door.
That's what everybody says.
So we would. Well, to our surprise, when we went in through that door, there was live music, but the room there was about 14 sets of dancers all doing set dancings, eight in each set.
Wow. Oh,
it was just a vibrant room. And we didn't even get time to heat those two seats to Mary Fox, who was the teacher at the time, a wonderful teacher and a wonderful dancer herself. She came over, she said, "We need you too," she says. "There's six people sitting out here waiting for two more." But before we knew it, we were in the middle of this swirling mass of people.
Yeah.
And to my surprise, Peter really loved it. I mean, I was more of a dancer than he was, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He really took to it. So he said, "I think we'll join the class." So we started joining the class. And I must say, I've been doing it for 30 years. It was 65 whenever I started.
Incredible.
And I've been dancing for 30 years. Now, I stopped during the COVID.
Sure.
But since that, we had Zoom. During that time, I kept in touch with the I did solo dancing as well, because there's some lovely old solo dances that away from the 1600s. And they're a bit more challenging, really, with the footwork, but lovely dances. So I did that shortly after I joined the sets, and Mary again was the teacher. And so during the troubled times there, we could have it in Zoom in our own kitchens.
Mm.
So that's what I did right up to the holiday time here now.
It's lovely.
And really, you know, it's a wonderful pastime, because it keeps you fit, because you've got to keep to that lively music. It keeps you fit. It keeps the mind active, because you've got to think of the. There's over 200 types of these sets, and so you have to sort of get familiar with what the pattern is of each one. And so you, in order to keep to be fair to the rest of the people in your set, and you're changing those sets every time.
Wow.
So you're meeting more people, and it's really very social and great fun.
It
has everything going for it. And I just feel that there's not enough people making use of it, really, because it really has been a great pastime.
That's great.
You know.
We often ask people if you could take anyone from Northern Ireland out for a cup of tea, dead or alive, who would you take and where would you take them?
Well, I could elongate this one, but I think I have to do that to explain it. It was a man called Thomas Smith.
Right.
Who was born in 1840. And he was born in Birmingham, actually. His father was a gardener. And as a young child, he would have imitated his father and made wee gardens and planted them. But at the age of 13, he became a garden boy for some big landowner. And then at the age of 15, he took apprenticeship with some well-known nursery. And so he worked his way through a lot of the well-known nurseries in England. And then he saw this, at the age of 30, he saw this advert for a manager for a small nursery in Newry. So he answered that and got it. And he fell in love with Newry.
Mm.
He adopted it as his town, and also he admired all the beautiful scenery around that part of County Down. So he always had wanted to start a nursery of his own. So eventually he bought 6 acres, which comprised of 2 hilly fields covered with daisies. And it was just on the west side of Newry, facing the hospital. And he started with a spade and started digging in one corner. And from that humble beginning, up sprang a nursery that was known worldwide.
Wow.
For its rare plants. And it gradually enlarged to 60 acres. And he had a workforce of between 70 and 80 men and women.
My goodness.
He introduced over 200 new species of plants. And this is what had got him the fame, you see, of other places. And on a Saturday morning, the local children would gather around his office door, and he would tell them wee stories about the beauties of nature. And he said, "Now, if you don't damage any of these plants, trees and shrubs," he said, "I'll reward you weekly." So what he did, every Saturday morning, he had gave them a scattering of pennies to pick up. And in those days, I mean, even in my day, when I was in the early 40s, if you got a penny, it was amazing what that big penny bought you.
Mm.
Never mind a way back in that era, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, he had a great personality. He was a very warm, generous man, Daisy, he called the nursery Daisy Hill, of course.
Yes.
And it was renowned for its hospitality, because he was that sort of a man. And one, I suppose, another reason, and he used to plant ornamental trees in Newry, because it was his town. And also he would supply the hospital, which was called New Union at that time, with flowers to brighten up the wards at that time. And they eventually changed their name to Daisy Hill, of course, Nurse Hospital. And another reason, another alternative motive for wanting to meet this man was he was Peter's great-grandfather.
Oh, wow, very good.
And he had inherited his genes, his grandfather's genes, as so had his two brothers. His love was in landscape contracting and designing and planting gardens. Patrick, who was the middle one, he ended up in botanic gardens and was sent out to Malaysia, Borneo, Papua New Guinea twice to again gather rare plants. So that was his love. And Brian, the third one, became one of the three top landscape architects in Northern Ireland the time that the town of Craigavon was being planned. So they all had inherited his but you know, if I could be so bold as to pick someone from the present day, it would be Dame Mary Peters, because I realise I have a great admiration for her, because in her day she had to excel at five different sports.
Yeah.
And in those days there was no scientific training or
Absolutely.
Anything like that.
Yeah.
And she was the driving force of her own training. And she thoroughly deserved that Olympic gold for that effort. And not only that, but she has dedicated the rest of her life to encouraging young people, 4,000 I heard the last count, to join sports, to take part in sports. And I mean, that is wonderful, and she deserves every honour that's been bestowed upon her, even to the top one in the land, which is the Order of the Garter.
Absolutely.
I really, and you know, as regards the coffee, but I haven't mentioned it yet. I led so busy a life that really I'd never time to frequent coffee shops or to get attached to any particular room. But at that time, Peter, he in his retirement, he started going every Saturday morning, leaving early to go to the St. George's Market.
Oh, lovely.
Because he wanted to get a place quite near. By this time, he wasn't just too fit, so he wouldn't have too far to walk. Well, he had a great admiration. He admired the skill and the tenacity of the marketeers.
Mm.
And with going early, it gave him a chance to do the rounds and chat to them all.
That's right.
And this was his routine. And, of course, that included the food stalls, because the aroma in that place was wonderful.
Yeah,
with all the different.
Yeah, yeah.
So at any rate, after he did his rounds, in fact, he was got to be quite a well-known character, because he had a big build, had a great head of grey hair, and a great bushy curly beard, which he inherited from the grandfather. The two of them had the same beard. But at any rate, and he had a wee small rucksack over one shoulder for any goods that he would be purchasing. So, he brought some lovely artefacts back, some beautiful artefacts, because there was great skill among those stall holders. So at any rate, then he'd finish off, he'd go and buy an Irish Times, make his way to the back of Upper Land's coffee stall, where wee folding chairs were set out with a little table, and he would sit down, order his first coffee, and turn immediately to the crosswork. Now, these tables and chairs, Peter used to carry them in himself. But the John and Julie, who owned the coffee business, they insisted then to take them home themselves and bring them in. You know, a wonderful.
Yeah.
And you know, their coffee was second to none. A wonderful variety of coffees. And they were two lovely people. And so at any rate, these chairs were set out. And Peter, he turned straight to the crossroad, because he did all the easy ones, you know. And he left the old ones, the hard ones, for the regulars that would be coming shortly afterwards.
Yeah.
And these regulars were actually a crowd of the dancers that we'd made great friends with.
Very good.
So they, of course, ordered their coffees and started to do the difficult ones. But while they were doing that, there was great debating going on, wonderful debating. There was one woman in particular, and she would join in the debate, and the same time you saw her, oh, she was wonderful with the hard clues, you know. So we called her the Queen of Crosswords. And other people would join us from time to time who knew the meeting place.
Yes.
But at any rate, Peter died in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, COVID was the next year.
Yeah.
Well, the coffee stall, they haven't returned to mm-hmm. the St. George's. So I hope wherever they are, and if they're still trading, that really, they enriched our life greatly. I have great thanks for them. And I hope that if they are still trading, that they're doing well.
What's their name again? I'll maybe
the Upperlands. The Upperlands Coffee.
Upperlands Coffee.
Upperlands Coffee.
Okay. What, do you remember the name of the couple?
John and Julie. She was interested in plants, and she used to have a little vase. Nothing elaborate, but just anything in bloom at the time,
yeah.
coming into bloom. And so Peter would have got two or three sprigs in to add yeah. to it, and they had some great chats about plants, you know.
Do you have a last name by any chance?
Hmm?
Do you have a last name, a surname for them?
Oddly enough, I never knew their surname.
That's fine. I'm sure that'll be enough to. I'm sure somebody listening will be able to.
Why?
Tell us who they are over there.
I never sort of thought about it. Peter probably could have told me.
Probably, yeah.
They were great. I really enjoyed those debates. Were wonderful.
That's good. Well, Isabel, final question for you. This is the question that we always end with, and it's very simply this. If you could go back in time to an 18-year-old version of yourself and you could give her a few words of wisdom or a wee bit of advice, what would you say to an 18-year-old Isabel?
Well, I'd say be a good listener and keep an open mind on all subjects, and never prejudge people. Always take them as you find them and treat them with respect, because it is a true saying, as you sow, so you reap in life.
Mm.
Take time to laugh, because there's a lovely old saying that says, laughter is the music of the soul.
Wow.
And a good sense of humour is a wonderful asset as you go through life. Now, last but not least, the advice we've all been given, if at first you don't succeed, keep persevering.
Mm.
And I would add to that, keep thinking positive.
Yeah.
That's it.
Lovely. Isabel, thank you so much for your time. It was lovely.
Did I overdo it?
Not at all.
I was conscious of the time, you see.
You did a great job. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that.